This is Mark Strassman, reporter with GridWorld. We're about to speak with Eugene Wong, who's the Deputy Secretary of Technology in the Commonwealth, to everyone else, that would be a state, of Virginia. Welcome to GridWorld.
Thank you, Mark.
Now, when doing just a very little bit of biographical research on you, it turns out you're from Los Angeles to start with.
That's correct.
And now I'm in Los Angeles, and you're in Virginia, and we're 3,000 miles away, and we're recording a conversation, and we're going to let millions of people hear it, and we all assume this is pretty commonplace. And it is now. But it really is a kind of amazing development in the history of the geology and biology of this planet. Wouldn't you say that creatures can communicate from 3,000 miles away and distribute it to everybody else, and it's just kind of a normal thing?
Well, I think, as my boss, the Secretary of Technology, likes to say, we truly live in a global interconnected world. Time zones and currencies and geographic borders are quickly becoming irrelevant in the 21st century. And much of that has been facilitated by networks, communications, and computing. And I think that phenomenon will continue throughout the 21st century, bringing our world closer and closer together.
In fact, as we're going to see as we discuss some of these specific items, some places are more connected than others, and that has important implications economically and politically and so on, and that's what you're involved with doing something about, presumably.
Yes, indeed.
Why don't you say just a little bit more about your personal journey to being where you are now, and what kind of interests drew you to the fields that you've been involved with that have led you to this position here in Virginia?
Sure. I've been involved with computing and communications technologies since I was a little kid. I can remember that my first computer was an Apple IIc growing up. But much of my background has been in the intersection of computing technologies and economics. I pursued an undergraduate degree in electrical engineering and economics at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia.
Right.
After that, I spent a short stint of time at the Federal Communications Commission in Washington, D.C. And following that, I was on the West Coast in San Francisco in the Bay Area with a startup company called BuildPoint Corporation, which was a business-to-business e-commerce company in the construction field. After the startup, I was accepted to a graduate program in economics at Oxford University, currently pursuing a PhD program at Oxford. And was at Oxford happily pursuing a PhD when Governor Warner called. He had indicated that he was just elected as governor of Virginia and asked if I would help him as Deputy Secretary of Technology. It's been a fascinating experience merging the interest in technology, the interest in economics, and policymaking. Virginia has been extraordinarily progressive in technology. It's one of two states with a Secretary of Technology. Whether it's the legal construct of technology,
Mark Strassman, things like GridWorld, we're about to speak with Dr.
Code for IT transactions, UCITA, or things like spam legislation. We passed last year the most comprehensive criminal code for spam in the nation, or things like Governor Warner's technology restructuring effort that he has going on in Virginia. It is made for a very, very exciting administration, and we still have 2 years.
Okay. 2 years, 2 years left at least, I guess.
Yeah.
You're saying. So you're essentially, your work and study and activities have circulated around something we could maybe call electronic economics, or the economics of electronic technology. And in that case, could you enunciate one or two basic principles that you've discovered from your academic work and your practical work that could be used to describe the relationship or the dynamics involved with the policy and economics of technology?
Well, I think that without question, what we see in today's 21st century global economy is that technology is one of those key infrastructures that underpins our global society. Without interconnected networks, without the pervasive use of technologies, we wouldn't have been able to get to where we are today. And so, in a nutshell, I think that what you'll see in the 21st century is that a basic level of fluency in technology is necessary and critical for success, and that whether it's infrastructure or using information technology and technologies broadly as a competitive advantage, it'll be critical to the success of not just private sector organizations, but nations as a whole.
Okay. This closely relates, it seems to me, to the digital divide issue, because in addition to needing a computer, you need fluency in the technology to a certain extent in order to be able to make use of it. Where is Virginia in its policies about the digital divide?
Virginia, in terms of
this
the digital
Mark
divide,
with World,
has been
Dr.
making
Carl
steps
Kesslin,
and has been taking
who is the
efforts
director,
to
Center for
that,
Technologies, Information Sciences Institute, University of Southern California.
Our
welcome to Grid World. How did you
broadly
end up in grid computing? Because when you were a student long ago, there were no grid computing
internet as well.
Facilities, institutes, or otherwise. But how did you find yourself where you are now?
Well, I would say I found myself where we are because we created it.
Okay.
So I would say somewhat modestly that myself along with my colleagues at Argonne National Laboratory played a significant role in creating what we now call grids. That's kind of how I ended up there.
About when were you doing that?
So the work that we've been doing is now going on close to 10 years. We originally started some of our very early work in what eventually became the Globus Toolkit back in probably 1994, 1995.
Even to all individual students?
All individual
looking
students.
Originally
and is that being paid for by the Commonwealth, by the local school board, by Apple?
Utilize
the
internet
school board, state-sponsored funding.
At that point, primarily associated with research institutions, but there were some
business deals
advanced
by
networking
Apple
experiments going on. I was looking at gigabit networks in the wide area and things like that. We were looking at how we could build computations that use distributed resources over the network.
So the idea was you were already transferring information, but you wanted to figure out how you could gradually transfer computing power.
Results were amazing.
Yeah, so that was kind of originally what we were doing. Of course, back then that was just really as the web was starting, but we were moving files and data around with RTP, and there was telemetry remote access. But we were really interested in looking at how to build up more general kinds of activities over the network. There had at that point been some early work done on an area that was sometimes called metacomputing, which was linking together large supercomputers to do computation. There was certainly some work going on in that area, and I would say what we really did was try to look very systematically at understanding what kinds of capabilities you would need and what kinds of functions you would need in the network to do this in a very general way. And that's really kind of what gave
to our
working grids
and the creation of the Globus Toolkit. Okay. Well, okay. So the people there, that though is only in one district,
and when asked about one part of the state, and there are various other districts.
Henrico
was sort of the first one out there. And I've been throughout the state where there have been various efforts ranging from our urban locales.
So certainly one of the things we've been doing from early on has been applications, but I think more it was we had a vision and saw an opportunity.
A lot of that was helped by
that the full power of the network would be realized not just by passing around web pages, not just by moving, doing a remote access, but actually using it as an integral part of our computing environment. So I think it was really more driven by a vision of the way things
leverage
should be.
What is out there
and it actually.
Okay, it sounds to me then that there's definite progress being made and it's having very good results at the high school, middle school level. Let's talk about a document called, I hope I can get through the whole thing, a proposal to enable collaborative development of terascale computational facilities by the Commonwealth of Virginia Virginia's research institutions. It was released in October 2003, and it went off to the your boss, the Secretary of Technology, George Newstrom. What's included in that proposal? Did you write it? Were you involved in it? What's the story about that proposal?
It's important to make this proposal.
In terms of the timing,
with
so
the other initiatives going on,
the network
in the
is a computer.
I'm actually going to break it down into
two separate
initiatives.
No problem.
In a way, actually, though, I tend not to like to think of it as just being a big
alternative
That's
kind of a pun by the scientists.
It's a social project.
Explain exactly what it is. What's this light rail that they're doing? It's not a bunch of trolley cars.
The reason why it's called the light rail project is that it's attempting to use existing rights of way and thoroughfares that have been carved out by the former rail system to lay fiber optic cable, dedicated point-to-point fiber optic cable between our nation.
Amounts of data, huge amounts of computing, and a lot of sharing going on.
And so, computing really provides an appropriate infrastructure for building those types of collaboration.
So let me give you an example, which is one of my current favorites. Is some work that's going on.
Virginia Tech, UVA, Duke, and so on and so forth. It is broadly characterized as Internet 3. In layman's terms.
Right.
And the whole notion of this is being able to use individual light waves, otherwise known as individual lambdas, to communicate directly between individual points. So what does that mean in layman's terms?
Right.
Well, it means that we're attempting to leverage computing power in multiple areas of our nation, where the sum is greater than its parts. The reason why individual light waves are important is that you're able to reach speeds where it almost becomes instantaneous, and there isn't the lag between using computing facilities in Chicago and Los Angeles.
Right, so if you're in Kansas or Chicago or Los Angeles and you're connected through this network, you can essentially make use of the computing resources instantaneously.
Exactly.
Okay. Exactly. And what is the proposal for Virginia to get it involved in this?
Okay, well, the National Lambda Rail Project was, when it was first conceived, to a large part bypassed the southeastern region of the United States.
Why was that?
Well, to a certain extent, the southeastern region has very few universities and facilities that are considered to be on the very cutting edge of computing and computing science.
Right.
Governor Warner took a look at this, and he said, "Well, you know, this isn't exactly, you know, we're talking about investing federal dollars here." And we believe that the southeastern region has a lot of talent to offer in this space through institutions like Georgia Tech and Duke and Virginia Tech and the University of Virginia. And so we're going to make a play to be part of the National Lambda Rail Project.
And in order to do that, you need a certain amount of infrastructure.
Exactly.
And exactly what kind of infrastructure do you need to participate?
Well, without question, you need a fair degree of fiber infrastructure. You also need, obviously, the researchers in your institutions of higher education who can take advantage of this and participate on a national scale.
Okay, so what was the proposal on the proposed budget that's been put forward for Virginia?
Well, so as I indicated, there are two separate efforts.
Right.
The first effort was more of a effort that was advanced by the individual institutions to participate in this National Lambda Rail Project.
Right.
It was facilitated through Governor Warner through the Southern Governors Association, and that led to an agreement between AT&T and an organization called SURA, which is the Southeastern University's Research Association, to provide low-cost access to dark fiber throughout the region.
Dark fiber is?
Dark fiber is unlit fiber optic cable.
Stuff that's in the ground and ready to go but isn't being used.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
So what did AT&T agree to do?
AT&T decided to provide a network in collaboration with the Southeastern University's Research Association at a fairly reasonable cost.
Okay, one they could afford. So what does Virginia still have to pay something to get what it needs?
Virginia does have to pay something, and I'm not exactly sure on the specific cost figures, but that cost is primarily being borne by Sura institutions.
Okay.
And so as I mentioned, there's a second half, and this is the part that you alluded to, which is a network, the collaborative proposal for terascale computing facilities
right.
within Virginia. The interesting distinction here is that the National Land Rail Project is a national project, and Virginia realizes, well, you know, we can get it down to the region, whether it's a node in Washington, D.C., or even North Carolina, but for institutions really to be able to use this computational power, it has to get to their institutions. And, you know, Virginia Tech is located in Blacksburg, Virginia, which is a relatively rural area of the state. Same with the University of Virginia, which is located in Charlottesville, Virginia. And so this proposal is an attempt to build off of the National Lambda Rail in sort of a spider webs way, as you will, to get this computing power to our institutions throughout Virginia.
Okay, where does this stand now in terms of budgeting and approvals and so on?
The institutions of higher education sought approximately $5 million in seed funding to get this project off the ground. And the higher institutions, although the institutions of higher education have some funds dedicated to it, they felt that they needed some state funding in order to really push it over the edge and get this properly started. We're in the midst of our legislative session right now, and so that is tied up in our General Assembly's budgeting process.
And how much are they going to have to budget?
Approximately $5 million for this initiative.
Okay, and what's the general political climate about networks and supercomputing and grids there in Virginia? Is it an issue that's being discussed widely in the media, or does it get less coverage than some, shall we say, less important issues?
Well, it is the issue itself has been subsumed by the larger debate that we have regarding the budget and taxation.
Right.
And like most states, Virginia has faced a significant budgetary shortfall for the last 2 years as a result of the downturn in the economy. Governor Warner earlier this year introduced a tax reform package which is set to increase revenue for the state by about $1 billion while lowering taxes to approximately 65% of Virginia's citizens. The important thing about the tax reform package is that the new revenue, after about $6 billion in cuts, is really dedicated to core priorities throughout state government. And one of those core priorities is research and ensuring excellence in Virginia's institutions of higher education. Understanding that the TerraScale project is one of those projects that fall under the umbrella of making sure that Virginia's research institutions remain competitive. That has been at the crux of the debate, which is ongoing in Virginia.
Okay, because sometimes it's hard to convince either politicians or the population that a dam or electric power lines are an important expenditure because of what they'll do in the longer term, and it may even be harder when talking about something which is to many people, I imagine, as abstract as supercomputing or grids.
Right. Right.
So, what kind of efforts are you making to educate people about the importance of both infrastructure in general and grid computing in particular?
Well, there are two specific things that have been happening. One is that Governor Warner time and again has emphasized that Virginia has only one institution of a higher education in the top 50 research institutions nationally. And
which one is that?
Virginia Tech.
Okay.
It's 49.
Right.
And in this day and age, when so much of your economic development is contingent upon not only well-educated individuals graduating from these institutions, but research efforts spinning off into new startup initiatives, whether it's in computing or nanotech or biotech. That investment in our higher education institutions is critical. And so that metric of top 50 institutions drives home the fact for many that Virginia has not been investing enough in its institutions of higher education.
So, in fact, you've got a grid gap.
Exactly.
Okay, two questions about that. One is, if Virginia gets organized and invests in high-performance computing solutions, and Iowa does, and Minnesota and Montana and Texas do, won't you sort of be in the same place relative to the other states and in terms of federal grants as you were when you started?
Without question. But I think one thing that we recognize is that these initiatives are statewide efforts that require collaboration across geographic boundaries. And one of the reasons why we focused on our southeastern states is an understanding that we can't do it alone. What's most important is that, you know, within the context of the global economy, that we all succeed in these endeavors. There are some states that have been focused on grid computing in the same way that some states have been focused in biotechnology and other initiatives. And we believe that through our efforts, Virginia will remain a leader in this particular field.
Okay. Talk then about the Southern States High Performance Network Grid and how that differs from the Lambda Rail project or the projects that are going on solely in Virginia.
Okay. Now, the Southern States Network Grid is an effort to expand the national Lambda Rail and the grid on a national basis to the region of the Southeast that has traditionally been characterized as not having the talent and or the facilities or the institutions to participate in these national efforts.
In fact, the problem really is if we were back in the age of railroads, is if the railroads crisscrossed the nation and left the South out.
Exactly, exactly. And so it's the exact same problem. And the effort here is really an attempt not only to get the grid to regions throughout the Southeast, but to highlight pockets of excellence throughout the Southeast region. I mentioned Georgia Tech. I mentioned Duke. UNC is in that realm. All of these institutions, Virginia Tech, UVA, have high-caliber programs that can benefit from these. And we're not only looking at institutions of higher education. When you take a look at facilities like Jefferson Lab in Virginia and Oak Ridge National Labs in Tennessee, here we have some national treasures in scientific research and development that can truly take advantage of the facilities that are being built nationwide.
Okay, now if these different efforts to build computing capacity and network capacity in the South don't succeed, is there a danger that to those that have more shall be given and those who have not shall be taken away, and that the places in California and Massachusetts and other places and Oregon and Illinois and so on that have already created themselves as the centers of these operations will just draw more people and more money and more activities and more breakthroughs and more money and so on, and the states that don't have it will just slip further behind, and the inequality on a regional basis, a regional level, will spread and intensify?
Mark, I think you hit the issue right on the head, and that is why Governor Warner has pushed so hard to put that metric of top 50 research institutions out there.
Okay.
We have three in the top 100, Virginia Tech, University of Virginia, and Virginia Commonwealth University. Because research in institutions of higher education today is a big dollar figure activity, and because success begets success, there is a recognition among policymakers in this state that if you don't, there is no such thing as standing still. You are either advancing or falling further behind. The goal here is to ensure that Virginia and Virginia's institutions, first and foremost, are part of that group that continues to advance the boundaries of knowledge. If we're not, as I mentioned before, initiatives like economic development, quality of life, all those issues end up being negatively impacted. And so it has been recognized by this governor as a priority of the administration.
You know, have those scientists who are studying every kind of thing from the bottom of the universe to the top have been studying actually the relationship between economic development and the positioning of high-tech research and development institutions? Have you been it's obviously what one of the things you've been studying.
The researchers in the labs and the universities obviously don't think about that particular relationship.
Right.
But it is a relationship that the university presidents are very acutely aware of. It's a relationship that policymakers are acutely aware of, and it's highlighted by organizations like the Southern Growth Policy Board, Southern Technology Council, as well as organizations like the National Science Foundation, which continue to show that there is a link between the activities of institutions of higher education and the general health and well-being from an economic perspective of the communities that surround it.
Speaking of the communities that surround it, let me try to just throw in a concept here. Stanford University, where I was present during the 70s and 80s, and I was watching...
Great institution.
I was watching this happen. I mean, that's the sort of, in the dictionary next to how research and development leads to economic development, there's a picture of Hoover Tower, I suppose. And my question, though, is with the technology itself that we're talking about, with the ability to deliver vast computing power anywhere on the grid, is there any thought being given to, instead of centralizing these institutions in one particular place, of dispersing them, distributing the institutions as well as the computing power, and letting people live in rural areas and help the economy there as well, instead of concentrating it so that there's less economic activity, sometimes too little in rural areas, and sometimes too much in the great urban university research centers that drive up property values and rents and all kinds of other amenities suffer and so on. Is that an element that might be factored into this whole process?
I think to a certain extent it is. I mean, with no disrespect to the urban institutions, and I certainly had my best years of my undergraduate career in an urban institution, institutions like Virginia Tech and the University of Virginia have taken a decidedly different model, where they are located in primarily rural or agrarian areas, and to a certain extent they have built communities of interest where you have individuals who are in an academic community who can feed off each other's ideas, advancing the boundaries of knowledge.
Right. The idea, though, is with this global grid, I mean, we're having a conversation here. I'm giving you an idea, you're giving me an idea. We're 3,000 miles apart.
Mm-hmm.
With broader band, more computational capability, it ought not be, shouldn't it be possible to have people globally, limited only really by, what time zone are you in and are you asleep, to be down the hall, virtually down the hall from each other, and do that kind of networking through the network?
Without question. Without question. And, you know, I think that the only constraint to that is that each and every one of us have to live in the physical world at some point.
Right.
In sociological terms, it's marrying the best of the offline world with the best of the online world.
Right.
Because, you know, you and me and everybody else have to live somewhere.
Right.
Whether it's in a rural community or, on a beach in Bermuda or in sunny California.
Right. Well, actually, it's
everybody
very clear,
has their own preference.
Okay. We haven't really yet come to grips with what the capability of these networks are and what they do and how they're enabling all this. Say a little bit about the I don't want to use the phrase where the rubber meets the road, but the idea of what actually is delivered by these grid computing networks that will be so useful in which areas in the coming years?
Grid computing as a technology delivers massive computational power to everything from research programs in bioinformatics, biotechnology, nanomaterials, to large-scale modeling of human events, whether it's weather, or you know, the classic case of large-scale computing, nuclear warhead simulations.
Right.
So it is all over the place in terms of what these technologies are able to provide. As I think both yourself and many of your listeners and readers can appreciate, biotechnology today and bioinformatics is significantly leading the way in terms of demand for computational power.
This involves finding solutions, developing new and more powerful drugs with fewer side effects, and understanding the human genome and the relationship between the genome and diseases, with an eye to treating them.
Exactly. And the sort of next big thing in bioinformatics is when you talk about drug discovery and clinical trials. Today we're basically in the dark ages. We take a look at a protein, and through a series of trial and error, we come up with a drug. And some of the drugs are successful, and some of the drugs are not successful. Through modeling and simulation of what goes on in the body in areas like protein folding, the hope is to radically accelerate that drug development process so that we can find drugs and treatments to some of the critical diseases that we have out there today.
Okay. I don't want to raise a huge issue here to deal with in a minute or two, but I'm wondering if you've got any thoughts about, when you say for us to find these solutions, who's going to be using this? Researchers? What's their relationship? Because, for example, right now, with the current level of technological development, there are drugs that are developed with NIH money, and they're marketed by private companies, and they cost five times more in some cases in the United States than they do in Canada. And this leads to a great deal of trouble in negotiation and threats and so on, back and forth between the FDA and the Canadian government and everybody like that. And my question is, as this power is generated by grids, who's going to have access to it, and to whose questions are going to get asked and answered, presumably, and who, what process do we need to have in place to make decisions about that if we need something new?
I think for right now, because grid, at least the terascale grid, is primarily in research and development stages.
Right.
At least for the foreseeable future. It is going to be used primarily by the computer science community to iron out, you know, basic things like protocols and the raw technical work needed to make these networks run and work. With most public infrastructures in computing, whether it is massive mainframe computing power, or grid power, or other types of infrastructure. Usually, there is a fair use doctrine where particular projects are reviewed by a committee of peers, and if it is found noteworthy, they get access to the facilities. The caveat is that your research has to be published in the public domain, and it needs to be freely available and used by the public.
Well, to be specific on that, if all this protein folding and genome research and so on, is that stuff in the public domain or is it proprietary to drug companies?
Some of it is in the public domain, and some of it is in
the private domain.
The private domain. And so what I anticipate is that for those companies that are looking to commercialize, the net-net of this is that these companies will probably have to either build their own grid networks,
right,
or lease time from a commercial provider in one way, shape, or form in order to take advantage of this.
Okay, because as I'm looking back, sitting here thinking about this, the telephone and the television and the car and radio and computers, as massive and important technologies as they are, have important, even central economic significance in the financial affairs of nations.
Mm-hmm.
And so if grid computing does rise to that level of importance, we can presume that the same kind of issues are going to arise around it. Is that reasonable?
I think so. And part of the reason why I'm not terribly bothered by those types of questions, at least for right now, is that we have seen how the Internet has come from military roots as DARPANET and ARPANET,
right,
into a commercially viable entity. And so, in cases where we have publicly funded infrastructure, our national highway system being one of them,
right,
the Internet being another one of them, it has eventually migrated its way into the public domain. Personally, I can't see 5 years, 10 years from now how all of this will lead out. But I think that there's sufficient precedent out there that these types of innovations end up trickling down into the public at large.
Well, just as a kind of warning, since I'm still in L.A. and you've managed to escape, on the question of highways, billions and billions were spent in the name of national defense and other reasons, and all roads are built by public money.
Uh-huh.
But the profits from the gasoline and the sale of the autos is privatized, and that's all going to private people. And here in Los Angeles, the result of that public spending on infrastructure and private control of the elements to move through it have led to what is increasingly a horrendous amount of permanent gridlock,
mm-hmm,
on all the roads. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering whether that combination of public subsidy for the infrastructure coupled with private control of how it's used needs to be looked at as a before we end up with another situation that we might not like, rather than after.
So, and Mark, without question, I think you raise a very, very valid issue. And I think to a certain extent, at least with computing facilities, there has been the Internet included, there has been a fairly strong tradition of peer and research review first. And the policy questions will emerge, and I don't think that there is a one-size-fits-all answer to these questions.
Okay, so you're saying the scientists are still in charge, and it's possible that they'll do a better job.
Certainly hope so.
Okay. What would you say are the major political, financial, and technical obstacles standing in the way of rapid and successful terascale deployment at this point?
I think the number one obstacle is funding, that's the $1 million, $10 million, $50 million question that is always lurking out
there.
Or
if you look at the deficit, the $450 billion question.
Exactly, and I think there is no question that these types of infrastructures cost lots and lots of money, I don't think that the days of big science in this country are coming back anytime soon, but I think that collaboration between federal government, state government institutions, institutions of higher education, are critical to advancing these initiatives.
Well, speaking of the financial issue, if the problem is finding money today for infrastructure developments that will pay off tomorrow,
mm-hmm,
there's something called bonds,
mm-hmm,
that can be floated by various institutions and paid back from the profits and benefits of the built infrastructure.
Is, mm-hmm,
are people looking into that, of doing grid bonds?
I don't think grid bonds per se, but whether it's bonding for facilities and research facilities and institutions of higher education, I think that it's something that a lot of states are pursuing, and it's something that in Virginia we have pursued for some research facilities for our institutions of higher education.
Okay. Last, more or less, last question. What are the problems that Terascale Computing is expected to solve, apart from bringing in money to pay for its development and spreading it throughout the community? What are the technical problems that remain unsolved that Terascale Computing can offer a unique way of addressing?
I think that for the computer science community, there are questions about, well, how do you get multiple computers to think in parallel across you know, many distances with potential lags.
Right.
And it's the same problem that some of the pioneers in RISC computing and parallel computing experienced very, very early on.
Coping with latency, in a
word. Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And so that and scheduling basic protocols and scheduling tasks between various computers. When we sort of think about grid computing today, it's still a fairly fairly new computing phenomenon, at least in terms of its maturity. As the technology advances forward, very, very simple questions of how do you efficiently harness the power of a you know, a computer with 100 times the power of one of the original Crays sitting in Virginia Tech, as an example. How do you do that?
Well, that's sort of my question. Once it's been done, let's say you create a hundred Cray unit Terascale computing network,
mm-hmm.
And you somehow deal with the latency issues and so on. What's it going to be asked to do? Are there major and valuable questions that have to be answered that can only be answered that way?
As I indicated before, I think that today I'm certain that there are questions that are currently being asked by scientists and research fields that there are no known solutions for with current computing power and technologies. And I am unfortunately not up and current in those fields to know all the research implications, but I do know that in my time spent with scientists and other individuals who are working on these problems, time and again, problems in biotechnology and nanotechnology are two fields that come up again and again and again. There are not necessarily easily comprehensible problems, but you know, in simple areas, whether it's drug design for and vaccines for various common diseases, or materials that can dramatically strengthen and alter the way we construct buildings, each of those unique fields has significant promise and potential for the future.
Okay, so when politicians say yes, you should, and yes, you shouldn't throw money at a problem, there are a lot of problems that you can throw computing cycles at,
mm-hmm.
that might conceivably lead to, and doing that might conceivably lead to faster solutions to some of those problems.
Without question.
What you're saying. Okay, that's all the technical stuff. Are you going to stay in place there in Virginia? You're going to go back to Oxford? What are your plans?
I have pledged to serve out the administration, at some point, my advisor keeps reminding me that I can't be ABD forever,
right.
And I do have to finish
ABD is
all but dissertation.
Yeah.
So,
well, you'll probably have a pretty good subject to write your dissertation on your years there in Virginia, won't you?
Well, without question, it'll be exciting to have served the Commonwealth when this is all is said and done, and it will be exciting to go back to the world of academia, where at least in Oxford, you have dreamy spires and rows of library books to go after.
All right, good. And probably by now, computer terminals, so you can access research resources anywhere in the world.
Well, let's just say that Oxford does have computer terminals, but it is fairly far behind the times, at least when you compare it to American research.
Well, that might be your next project, is gridizing the United Kingdom when you get back.
Indeed.
Okay. Thanks very much for talking to us about your efforts to do it in Virginia in the South, and hopefully a lot more people will have some more information about it now and be able to make better decisions about what has to be done. So thanks very much for talking to us on Grid World today.
Great. Thank you so much, Mark Strassman.
Talk to you later. Bye.